Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Enterprise Business 100, Section 16 for Autumn Semester 2014. Special Lecture 1, delivered on November 19, 2014. The title of this lecture is Business Law.
Today, Business Law. This lecture is compact. It covers a lot of material. Essentially, as I mentioned before the podcast began, this is a lecture that encompasses somewhat of a summary of a full introductory business law course. And it won't address just business law, because business law is just one aspect of law. And what I'm going to do, the way I do this, is I take law and I divide it up different ways, in two different parts, maybe four different ways. Here's one way. I can separate common law from statutory law. Common law, well, it's actually easier to start with statutory law. Statutory law is written law. It's written down. This is the law done by the legislature or done by a council. It's all written down. Maybe the greatest example of statutory law in history was Lex Romana, the law of the Romans. Everything was written down. A judge just opened the book. There is the law. There was no judgment involved, really. Just this is how it is. Now, because Rome was an empire, it spread through Europe, well, some of Europe, into the to the east and into England to a certain extent, but not really too strongly in England, certainly not up in the northern parts of Europe. But because Rome was a statutory law-based empire, all of its occupied territories embraced statutory law, the law that is written down. So, for example, France to this day is a statutory law country. Everything's written down. Kind of the hallmark of France's representation of Lex Romana was the Napoleonic Code. But certainly we would see statutory law in Italy. You would see statutory law in other countries that were under the sway, full sway of the Roman Empire. Statutory law becomes large as a society lives on through its nation, its sovereign. More and more laws will build up in it. In the case of Lex Romana, it got so complex, so large, so influenced by this interest, that powerful person, or that wealthy family, or this noble group, that it eventually lost all touch with the common people. A lawyer would not be able to know Lex Romana. There was a joke that was supposedly told, oh, did you talk to that lawyer about your problem? Yeah, but he knew page 5,863, paragraph 4, and I needed page 5,463, paragraph 7, so I couldn't use him. It gets that intense. Interestingly, though, it is a powerful hallmark of a society, of a civilization, a body of statutory law. So when the Roman Empire finally, quote-unquote, fell with the last raidings by the Visigoths in the late summer of AD 476, I think it was, the Visigoths did not throw out Lex Romana. They turned it into Lex Romana Visigoth, the Visigoth law of the Romans. And it still applied to Roman citizens for a century or more afterwards. But because there was no expertise in this law, once the empire had collapsed, what they call Lex Romana Visigoth was just a hodgepodge. Sort of like they pulled parts out that they thought were important. They threw in stuff that they found from constitutions. It was just kind of a mess. And it was just a sort of representative of how complex the law had become that the inheritors of the empire couldn't really make sense of it, even though they respected it. Distinguish that from common law. This is, as I call it, tribal law, the law of the elders. It is oral law. It is law that is passed down. In common law, we have a Latin term, interestingly enough, stare decisis. Look back to the previous decision in this matter. So in other words, you would not just be able to read a book, okay, here's the law. You would have to know the body of decisions that had been made over the history of your society in order to adjudicate a case. One place I was most impressed by this was when I talked to a professor from Ethiopia. He said that a person would have to be in his 50s before he could adjudicate even a simple case of law, because you have to spend your lifetime knowing what the elders have decided in this, knowing all the nuances, all the possibilities that could come up over time. Stare decisis is as strong in its decisions as statutory law, but there is that flexibility. A judge can, or a jury, can consider, well, there's something about this case that we have not seen in older decisions. But for the most part, stare decisis is what rules. You can't just decide against something that has been decided before. You have to respect the precedent. Common law was the law of among many, many places on earth. Because the Roman Empire did not push very strongly into Germania, certainly not into the lowlands, and certainly not into the Northmen territories, they had common law. And when there were three different tribes of lowland Germans, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, who began to migrate in the 4th and 5th centuries of the Christian era into the British Isles. They started moving in. There have been movies about it, you know, the evil Saxons and their horn hats chopping up the Druids and the Picts and all that. But they came in, they overcame resistance, and they applied the common law of the Germans, of the lowland Germans, to England. And so, as this thing, England, began to come into a real political setup with four different, basically, warlords areas and many smaller warlords, they all had common law. And so as the society consolidated around a central, powerful king, a warlord, common law and a body of common law that they had inherited from the lowlands of Germany, from where they came to England. So England was common law. Oddly, though, something strange happened. In 1080, 1066, the Normans, a lowland, a French-Germanic group of Frenchmen, invaded, and at the Battle of Hastings, they beat the English crown. And so England came under the political control of French people. Interestingly, they were Germanic French, which was ultimately what made them kind of fade and get absorbed into the English world, the English society. But for several centuries, they and their statutory law put itself down on England. And what we got out of it was sort of this hybrid blend of statutory and common law. And it came with the immigrants from England to the United States, here it came over here. this weird blend of written law and common law operating at the same time. So we come to a society here in the United States that has a hybrid, written laws and common law. And some areas dominate one, and some areas are dominated by one, and some areas are dominated by the other. For example, criminal law would be almost exclusively statutory. Civil law, lawsuits, things like that, contracts, those are common law. There are laws written about it. Legislatures aren't going to leave anything unlawed, but it still boils down to common law in civil. And we're going to talk a lot about civil here, because a lot of business law has a civil component. So here we go. New country opens up, and it has legislatures that pass laws, and they are signed by the president, or he vetoes them and all that kind of stuff. But it's written law. And that the founding fathers said, okay, well, this is okay. And we started moving forward through the late 1700s after the country was formed. But the Constitution actually had provision for courts and for a Supreme Court, a high court of the land. And there was a case early in the life of this country. The case was Marbury v. Madison. And this went to the Supreme Court, a very young Supreme Court, still finding its bearings maybe, appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate and all that kind of great stuff. But in this decision, the Supreme Court put its foot down, and we had the first ruling giving judicial review to the courts. In other words, the legislature can pass laws, and they are the high law of the land. However, if a petition is brought before a court, specifically the Supreme Court, and the court finds that that law is unconstitutional, that law is no longer valid. Judicial review simply says laws are fine and they are the high law of the land until we have a look at it. And if we do review it and we find that it is inconsistent with the Constitution, we're going to throw it out. And you can't do shit about it. Unless you want to try to pass a new law that obeys what we told you when we in our holding and in our rationale. And of course, when a court writes, like the Supreme Court will make a decision in a case. And that would be the holding. But it will also provide a rationale. Okay, these were the cases that came before. This is how it was ruled before this. So we're binding on that. This is how your law does not meet constitutional inspection. And that is a guide for the law legislature. If it's really hard up and it likes that law and it wants to do it, it's going to have to recraft the law so that it is in compliance with what was said in the rationale of the Supreme Court's decision. No, you can't just pass the law again and defy us. We'll just knock it down. Matter of fact, we won't have to knock it down because a lower court has to obey a higher court. We've said this law isn't valid, so if you try to pass the same law again, the lower court, it won't even make it to us. The lower court's just going to kick it out. There is the power of the tribe, the tribal elders coming to bear on American law. Legislatures can pass all the laws they want. They can be ridiculous laws. And unfortunately, way, way, way too often, legislatures will pass mean, unconstitutional, irrational, silly laws, but no one has the wherewithal, the money, the time to challenge them in the courts. And of course, you have to go through the court system, the trial court, which the trial court will just obey the statutory law. But then, if there is a constitutional question, it will go to an appellate court, which can rule one way or the other, and then whichever side loses at appellate level can take it to the Supreme Court. And there, again, it will be reviewed. And so that's an expensive process. It's a tedious, time-consuming process. So you will see a lot of statutory law that is absolutely ridiculous. It's just completely silly. But no one's ever had the power to challenge it in a court, had the money and the time to go through all of the layers. So injustice can be done in that regard. And unfortunately, the other side of that is that there are people who have plenty of money who are constantly challenging reasonable laws, and this burdens the courts terribly. Business law is different. And I'll get to that in just a minute. But anyway, okay. That's civil, common versus statutory law. Now, I'm going to quickly go criminal versus civil law. In criminal law, you have harmed the sovereign. It is the people versus in a criminal law case. You have murdered him. Okay? Now, he's pissed. Well, I would be pissed, you know. I'd on my gravestone, I'd have my tombstone would read, "Well, this sucks." Okay. Well, this is the bereaved brother. You look like no, you don't. Okay, a bereaved brother here, and so he's got a problem with what you did. Well, I stride in. The prosecuting attorney for the state. Ha ha ha. Damned woman. And I prosecute. I'm not prosecuting on behalf of him. Oh, they'll bleed their hearts and they'll go to the news media. Oh, we're going to make this man feel better about this injustice to him, to his brother. We're going to right this wrong against this dead man. That's bullshit. I, the prosecutor, am representing the society. The people as a whole. I will use him. I will use his dead body and the really cool photographs of what you did. My God, woman, those knife, that knife set you got on that infomercial really did work. And I will bring him up during sentencing to tell how his life has been ruined. But that really isn't what's going on. I am the sovereign. And I am going to prosecute you on behalf of the sovereign. If he wants to do something to you, he has to sue you in civil court, not in criminal court. His beef with you is a person against a person. That's civil law. Criminal law is the sovereign against the person. We the people. There was many years ago, it's before your time, there was a television show called The Andy Griffith Show. And Andy Taylor, the sheriff of the town, he had been ticketed for something, for not using his turn signal at a stop sign. So he brought in his dumb friend, Goober, to attest that I was in the car, I saw him turn on the signal. As they were sitting there with the trial about to begin, the judge walks in and the bailiff reads, "The people versus Andy Taylor." Goober, his eyes got big and he said, "Gee, Andy, you didn't tell me everybody was against you." Well, yeah, when you're in that courtroom, everybody's against you in a criminal trial. The civil is something else entirely. Civil has to do with wrongs of one against another. Business law, quite frequently, much business law is civil law. If I sue a company that has given me, I ate at Taco Hell and I got the trots, so I sue Taco Hell. That's a civil lawsuit. Taco Bell, wronged me, so I'm going to go after you on that basis. Criminal law, there is business law that is criminal law. Unfortunately, it is actually quite weak. Interestingly enough, we very rarely see criminal law being applied to businesses. Even though businesses commit crimes, quite frequently, it is rare that they are ever prosecuted criminally. Now, understand something about common law. Common law, even people who have any knowledge or limited knowledge of the Anglo-Saxons, imagine them as being brutal, violent, hate-driven people, killing everything in their path, grunting as they pillage villages and all that kind of stuff. Actually, no. Even going back ancient, far before this time, you see, all the peoples of Europe down to India, even into northern Africa, spreading into eastern Europe, they all came from a common tribal grouping. We call them the Proto-Indo-Europeans. They were all living around the Black Sea. Maybe about 5,000 years ago, something happened in that area of the world. We figure it probably was environmental and population pressure. But there were a lot of these tribes, and they all spoke a fairly common language, and they all had a fairly common culture. And they just started spreading out. Just all of a sudden, they just started migrating away. We know this happened because all of the languages of Eastern Europe, Western Europe, even down into the Middle East to some extent, Northern Europe, they're so similar that if you know how they work, you can go from one language to the other without much problem. As a matter of fact, the first who noticed this were a pair of brothers better known for their fairy tales, the Grimm brothers. But anyway, all of these tribes all over that came from the Black Sea area, they have a very similar perception that comes down clear to this day of civil law. Here's one of the most important principles of it. You, woman, have wronged me. I want blood. She hurt me. I want her neck. And if I don't get it, I'm going to kill her. And I'm going to kill her dog. I'm going to shoot her Bible right in the middle of it. I'm going to sell her dog on Craigslist. And I'm going to make her mama wear furry costumes that I like. Mrs. Fox is really cool. This is a starter kit on Amazon. Okay. Anyway, think of how a society would work if every time you were wrong, the society lets you just take it out like the Scots do. Clan war over and over and over again through history. 500 years ago, some guy wronged the other guy's brother, so now we still kill each other to this day. Early on, in the tribes of the Black Sea, they said, we can't live that way and have a functioning society. So civil law is dedicated to keeping people away from each other on a blood level. You wronged me. I'm going to take you to a court, and I don't care if you want to hurt her or whatever. No. At best, you're going to get some money. That's it. You're not going to be able to slap the shit out of her. You're not allowed to. That's civil law. You see, it protects us from going back to animals. We've now found, shockingly, it's been known for, since time immemorial, but I'm reading about scientists who are finding out that primate societies like chimpanzees, they kill each other. They are murderous. They torture each other. They are horrible in that way. And that, of course, is why they're monkeys and not humans, for God's sake. One of the things about evolution into humanity is that we stop trying to hurt each other all the time with blood, and we have a system that allows us to take our grievances before a tribal council, in our case, civil courts, and have a decision made. And everyone has to live with that decision. That's how civil law works in its ideal. It's not about revenge. It's about compensation. And that's why you might hear, well, this burglar broke into this house and the guy had a shotgun trap and he killed the guy. Ha ha, oh my God, that guy's family is suing him in court. Oh, that's horrible. I mean, that's not just. Yes, it is. Because if you go to blood for blood, all he did was break into a house. Did he deserve to die for that? I can shoot him if he's on my property. You try that. Watch the family of the deceased take your ass to court and take away everything you own. That's right, because it keeps blood for blood from being part of our society. If you like that, well, wait for the zombie apocalypse. Then you can have your fantasy. But anyway, that's criminal versus civil law. By the way, in civil law, I'm not going to focus too much on criminal law here, but in civil law, there are a couple of areas of civil law that are kind of important for us, and I'm going to go through one of them in more detail than the other. But there's tort, and another area of civil law is contract law. Contract law is civil law. But first, let me mention tort. A tort is a civil wrong against another. A tort is a civil law wrong against another. So, give you some examples. Assault, a civil assault, not a criminal assault. Remember, a criminal assault would be this: you have wronged the state by hurting a citizen of the state. But if we're talking about civil assault, that's an assault. Wait, what? Putting a person in concern for his or her safety. Not imminent fear. You didn't fear me. I don't know why you don't fear me. You should fear me. But you didn't fear me. But I put you in at concern for your safety. That's assault. Now, I'm going to... Okay, I can't do it to a girl. I'll do it to a guy. Okay. Can you stand up and turn around? No. Built like a brick shit. That's battery. An unwanted touching of another. That's battery. Civil battery. An unwanted touching. There's a confusion about what assault and what battery is. Assault, you just have to put a person at concern for his or her safety. If you touch, that's, if you have any kind of unwanted touching, it can be from feeling of that strapping young man, my God, those muscles, where did you, anyway, on through to grabbing his buttocks, that's a battery. That's the battery part. That's the civil. Now, there is a criminal version of it, understand. But the civil version, you can take me to court for what I did. I'm sure you won't because you liked it. But you understand now the difference? That's tort law. Tort law could be, for example, you're married to a very, very handsome, muscular guy, and he's really nice, and you love him, and the two of you have a wonderful time together. And I'm driving a car, and I hit your car with your husband in it. He's not killed, but he goes into the airbag, and the airbag doesn't work exactly right, and he hurts parts of him that you kind of look forward to from time to time. He can sue me for hurting him in civil court. The insurance company is going to try to keep that from happening by paying, again, that liquidated damages thing, trying to keep it civil. But you can sue me for denial of consort. You know what that means, right? You got that, right? You can sue me for denial of consort because even though I didn't hurt you directly, you came out of the accident fine. But because I hurt your husband, you can sue me because I have harmed you through the harm that I caused him. That's a tort, okay? Other kinds of torts that you can talk about. There are so many different kinds of torts that, and you. One of the fun things is if you, I don't know if you'd find it fun, but when I was learning Old English, the language of the Anglo-Saxons, they had all these words for what you could do to another person that was a tort, like humsocken. If you walk up to a person on his property and punch him in the face, that's humsocken, and that's a tort. And the elders would say, well, you did wrong, you have to pay him a couple of shillings or give him a pig or something. Okay, that's tort law. And if, for example, a good example of that in businesses would be if I run a business that causes harm to another person, that could very well fall under tort law. If I run a restaurant and someone gets diarrhea that puts them in the hospital, that I've committed, allegedly committed, a tort against that person. So businesses as persons can be subject to civil law. Sometimes businesses sue each other in civil court on matters, okay? So the other one is contract law. Contract law. This is the big 800-pound gorilla. And to those who are listening to this podcast who are not my students and you're saying, well, you didn't say this or you said this wrong, bite me. I'm trying to get it all done in 75 minutes of lecture, an entire introductory law course, so kiss my ass. Okay, contract law. Now, contracts, okay, and I might have already done this one with you before, but I'll do it again. What is the first thing necessary for a contract to come into existence? You are an accountant. Why did I even bother? Woman, what's the first thing necessary for a contract to come into existence?
Two people.
Well, yeah. Yeah, you can't contract with yourself. That's a very, actually, believe it or not, that is an important thing to remember. There have to be two separate parties, two separate persons. They could both be people, or the one could be a corporation, one could be a person, or they could both be corporations, but you do have to have at least two parties. Okay, but for a contract to be created, what has to happen? What's the first thing that would be necessary? You got nothing? Oh, you helped me out enough. You. Good. They have to have an agreement. You're exactly wrong. There has to be a disagreement. Before you can have an agreement, there has to be an actual or potential disagreement. Why would you contract if there was no possibility at all of a disagreement? There was no way in the world that any kind of dispute could ever arise. No dispute exists, and no dispute could ever arise. You would have no reason to come to an agreement and then have a contract. So that's why, by the way, you cannot contract with yourself, because you cannot disagree. You might think you can. You might have, well, I made a contract with, you cannot disagree with yourself. You can't sit there, oh yeah, yeah, slut, Presbyterian. You can't do that. Rastafarian, Republican, you can't do that. It doesn't happen in real life. Unless you are one of those weird-ass split personality, but they don't know each other, exists from what I've seen in the movies, but you can't do it. So that's why you can't contract with yourself. But a contract first requires a disagreement, either actual or potential. That's why when you write a contract, you're not thinking just only about what is on the table, but what could be on the table. And that's especially true with business contracts. So, you have to have an agreement, a disagreement, then you come to an agreement. But an agreement does not rise to the level of a contract. Only some agreements rise to the level of a contract. Some agreements rise to what's called the level of quasi-contract. But in order for it to be an agreement to be a contract, it must meet four very clear pillars. Now, you go into some business courses, they'll say three. Some business courses will say five. I was in a business law course, 12 pillars. Four works. Damn it. Okay, and here are the four. The four pillars that make an agreement a contract. Now, you can have agreements. You have agreements all the time in your life. But do they rise to the level of a contract? First of the pillars that make an agreement a contract is offer and acceptance. Offer and acceptance. Now, as far as, and by the way, that's why sometimes you'll see five, because they'll separate offer from acceptance. I keep them the same. I keep them on one because they are interacting. Offer. The offer must be serious. The offer must be serious. The offer must be specific. And the offer must be timely. Serious, specific, and timely. Okay. Okay, you. You work at McDonald's. I come in, and I look at your menu board, and you're standing there looking all perky and broad. May I McHelp you, McSir? Yes, I McYes. I would McLike a Big Mac, and a McFries, and a McShake. Well, McOkay. Now, did you offer me a meal?
No.
Why not? Why not? I was the offeror. You were the offeree. Or as representing McDonald's. Why was McDonald's not offering a meal to me? And be a little more specific. Specific. That menu board is not specific enough. It didn't give me a number of Big Macs or a number of McFries. It was not specific enough to be an offer. And that's the whole thing. Advertisements are not offers to sell products. You don't want an advertisement to be an offer to sell a product. You want it to be a solicitation for an offer to sell a product. But you do not want an ad to be an offer, because then acceptance is controlled by the offeree. So you want an ad to have just enough vagueness in it in order for it not to be an offer. An example of when this did not happen, many, many years ago, and I believe it was during the Great Depression, this is a kind of famous case. A big, high-end, fancy store opened in New York City, and for rich people to go and get stuff that they wanted in a time when everyone else was miserable. But they announced the store's grand opening would occur on a certain day, and the first 100 people through the door would each get a free fur coat. A free fur coat. Well, and they put it in the New York Times. I think it was in the New York Times that they put it, this ad. And so opening day, there was a nice line. And up about, well, maybe about 20 people in, this kind of raggedy guy walks through the doors and says, "Where's my coat?" "You don't get a coat. Get the hell out of here. I want my coat. I was one of the first 100. And he made a scene, and they roughed him up and threw him out on the street. He sued. Under contract, saying that he was offered a free coat and he accepted it. And the department store says, "We all know this is established law. Advertisements are not offers." And the court ruled yours was. It said it was clearly serious. It told the number of coats you would get and where and what time you would get them. That was an offer. Give the man his coat. Pay his lawyer. You got it? Don't make your ad that specific, because then you're going to have made an offer. Okay? Acceptance. The first part of acceptance you have to know is what is called the mirror image rule. The mirror image rule. The mirror image rule is this. The acceptance must exactly mirror the offer. I've got a car and I'm selling on Craigslist for $1,000. You call me up and say, can I see the car? So you come over and you look at it, you kick the tire. Yeah, I'll take it, $800. And I say, no. No. Well, okay. Now what you did by offering me $800, you killed my offer. I was offering the car. A counteroffer kills an offer. It's dead. As soon as the counteroffer has been made, the original offer is gone. It's with Jesus. Okay? So you call me up a couple of days, I'm going to take your offer. No, you're not. Well, yeah, I am. You offered it. No, that offer is dead. You countered. So your counter is on the table and I reject your counter. Now you're going to give me a counteroffer. Okay? We go to an auction. We're going to sell this fine young man at a Christie's auction. Today at our auction, we are going to sell this fine young man. He is good for work, good for play. He's great with kids, and he does cook meals quite well. Do I hear an offer for $20? Do I have an offer for $20? Okay, see, the auctioneer is not making an offer. The auctioneer is soliciting an offer. You just raised your bottle. We have $20. $20. Do I have $30? What I'm doing now is soliciting a counteroffer, because if someone offers $30, which you just did by looking at your nails, I know that's an offer. You just killed hers. So you now have a counteroffer. And now $30. Do I have $40? $40. Is $40? Everyone's freezing. I ain't go by the way. $40. Okay, $30. Going once, going twice. Ah, damn. Really? The gavel going down is acceptance of the last offer. That's what the gavel means. It's the acceptance. And it's ancient auction law. The gavel means I accept the last offer that was made, okay? Mirror image rule, though. Unless your offer is, your acceptance is identical to the offer, then you do have actually killed the offer and you have created a counteroffer. And so keep that in mind. Now, the second pillar, mutual consideration. Thing of value for thing of value. Thing of value for thing of value. I keep picking on the same people because they haven't lashed out at me with nails or anything like that. Okay. It's an alternate universe. And I'm a young man, not an old geezer with a crooked big nose. Do you know how much it pisses me off when people look at my nose and they just start kind of looking the way that my nose is pointing? Anyway, but it's an alternate universe where I'm good looking, I'm fun to be around. And so I say, madam, I should like to take you out on a date. I will show you a very good time. And you say, why, of course, kind sir. So I take you on a great date. We go bowling. And after that, I take you to Denny's. I mean, order whatever you want. You get a couple of Grand Slam meals. Okay? And then I escort you back to your hovel. And at the door, you thank me for the evening. And you start to walk in. And I say, bitch, I want a huggy. And you, well, no, I'm not that kind of girl. You're hurting me, Ted. You're really hurting me by asking me for a huggy. What do you think I am? I bought you. You took bowling And you beat my ass. What the hell was that about? And then we go to Denny's. I say, get whatever you want. You get two grand slams. And then you get that big dessert. And I you owe me a huggy. Does she? No. A gift is not a consideration. It is not, if you accept a gift, it's not, does not create a contract, because there is no meeting of minds involved. First of all, you got to watch it with contract law and anything that has to do with sex. That gets complicated. But just taking it on basic contract law, no, there was no mutual consideration involved. A gift is not, if you take a gift, you haven't. You're not saying I'm in a contract. That's why, ladies, you can take an engagement ring and tell the guy to kiss off, because he gave it to you. Well, I gave you a car, so I expect you to major in accounting. Or I've paid for your education. I expect you to get a job. We agreed to this. Bullshit. A gift is not a contract. You take whatever you want. If it's offered, just give it to you. Nope. Now, there's an exception to this, but we'll get to that in a minute here. But it has to be thing of value for thing of value. And there has to be a very close association of the mutual considerations in time. In other words, it has to be rendered, both sides have to be rendered fairly close to each other. There's an exception to that called promissory estoppel, where you don't have to pay right away for something that you've gotten in a contract. But for most purposes, consider mutual consideration, thing of value for thing of value, very quickly rendered back and forth in time, and that's it. And there are many cases that have established. The case law in common law, you can't get around that. You take a gift, that's not a contract, unless it's a really specific thing. Okay, now, the next one is capacity. Capacity. You have to be capable of entering into a contract. Understand this. Just because you're drunk or on drugs does not in and of itself provide defense against having signed a contract. Well, I was drunk. I signed that contract while I was drunk. You're going to find out that a court says that is not enough to overrun capacity. You still could have judged differently. Some courts are now really into some of these psychological drugs are really affecting people's brains. But aside from that, just saying I'm drunk, so that contract is void, you can't do that, really. So don't say, well, I'm going to get drunk and then I'll sign a contract for a loan for a car. Nah, not really. That's not going to play it. This is actually good in the sense that since time immemorial, for example, people with Down syndrome, there were laws that prevented them from getting married because they didn't have the capacity to enter into a marriage contract. That's just absolutely bullshit. We now know that that's not true. If you have just Down syndrome, doesn't make you incapable of understanding contract. In fact, we now have people with Down syndrome who are getting masters and PhDs. It's not that you are defective in your mental ability in some fundamental way. It's just that you have a very different way of processing things, but you can understand a contract. So a lot of those laws say, well, Down syndrome people can't get married. They're being knocked down by courts because they have capacity. Here's the danger, though. A contract with a minor is voidable at the discretion of the minor unless it is for a necessity. Again, a contract with a minor is voidable at the discretion of the minor unless it is for a necessity. Do you understand what that means? If you enter into a contract with someone under the age of 18, that person can just say, I herewith void it, after they've taken your stuff. They can do it unless it is for a necessity. Now, let me give you a case, and usually I do more cases than in this quick one. Usually I do this two lectures, but here's a case. A father and his 16-year-old son had an ugly falling out, just an absolutely horrible one. The son stormed out of the house, crashed with a friend for a couple of nights, and then went over and he signed a lease for his own apartment. And, of course, as things usually happen, mostly in the movies, but this happened in real life, the father and the son had a reconciliation. You know, the tears and the slobbers and, you know, the music in the background, the romantic music, happy family times and all. They actually had a full reconciliation. Come back home, son. You okay with it? Oh, yeah, Dad. Sorry. I am too, kid. Okay, well, that's wonderful. So, the next morning, the son calls the apartment complex and says, I herewith void my lease agreement with you. I can do that because I'm a minor. A contract with a minor is voidable at the discretion of the minor. The management company said, yeah, but it's voidable at the discretion of the minor unless it's for a necessity. And shelter is a necessity. You're stuck for 12 months of rent payments. Sorry, kid. It went to court. Okay? Obviously, the plaintiff here was the management company who said, you're not paying your rent payments, and we're going to sue you. Okay, so the plaintiff says, this was a minor, yes, but it was for a necessity, which is shelter. So it is not voidable. He is liable for all 12 of the payments, monthly payments. The father and the son came back and said, no, it wasn't a necessity because he had a place he could live. It was not necessary. He could have come back home. The management company then dug in its heels. No, at the time he signed it, he was under the full impression that he could not go back home. And so at the time of the signing, he was capable of making the decision to enter into a binding, non-voidable contract. Back and forth it went. Who won? What say you? What was the holding of the civil court? For the property management company, the plaintiff, or for the father and son, the defendants? Who won? Plaintiff? You better not believe it. Because the plaintiff, clearly, I would have called, as a matter of fact, when the law professor pointed to me and said, I said plaintiff. And he said, no, you dumbass. He said, because it doesn't matter what the state of mind of the signatory to the contract was. He was a minor. His state of mind didn't matter. It was the reality that he had a home that mattered. Ouch! Don't contract with minors, for God's sake. I don't care how cute that 13-year-old is. Don't do it, okay? Finally, legality. Legality. You got sick of college. You decided that you were going to join the Navy. You've been in for basic. They put you right on a ship. You traveled all over the world on the ship, and you've finally gotten your first shore leave. It's later in the evening. There's a slight rain falling, and you are wandering alone, and you come along an alley, dimly lit, but you're walking along, and you suddenly, what's that? Is that blues music playing? Quietly, you walk down the alley, and then you notice that there's someone standing against a light post, looking at you. And you come up, getting closer, and you see, I'll hear a voice say, hello, sailor. Are you a lonely boy? You get a little closer and you realize it's me. I lost my job here because of freaking weird ass lectures. So what do you say? Would you like to have a good time? $50 and I'll make you a very happy guy. Come on, lonely boy, let's go to the YMCA. Yeah, we're talking YMCA. You don't pay me my $50. I sue you in court. Do I win? Up or down? Do I win? Down? What wasn't legal? What did I offer him?
A good time.
Bingo! The YMCA has exercise equipment, saunas, it has even a TV room, it has treadmills, and it has this group of four guys dressed in weird outfits singing YMCA. I didn't offer him anything illegal.
Yes, you did.
You, madam, have a tarty, saucy, dirty, indeed, mind. You understand that legality is sometimes a little bit dodgy. When I was a court reporting teacher, we would read transcripts of actual trials for the court reporters. And we would, for the early ones, at a speed of like 5 words a minute, so, and then 10, then we'd get up to 40, then to 80, to 120. We finally get them up to 225 words a minute. We were just talking at high speed, and the court reporting students were just rattling along. So we got this one transcript that was famous, and we never told the students about it, but it was a famous transcript. There was a trial, and we were reading the back and forth during the preliminaries to these court reporting students. And the bailiff read the charges. The charges include 13 bags of hallucinogenic mushrooms. And then the other person who was reading with me yells it for the defendant's voice, "There were 20 bags, man! That cop ripped me off!" Of course, that didn't make his case any better. But anyway, look. It has to be something that's legal to do. You have no contract if it's not legal. You don't even have quasi-contract if it's not legal. Okay, so keep that in mind when you are working with contracts. It has to be something that it's legal to do. And if it's not legal, then it is outside of the realm of law because the court will not consider a contract in that case. Now, I'm going to do a couple of last divisions here that have, now that I've put in some beef into this part, with contracts, there are certain divisions I need you to know. Oral versus written. Now, you hear this thing, verbal. That is one of those misused words. Verbal is oral or written. In law, we have to understand the difference between an oral contract and a written contract. Okay, so I have gotten myself wrong. I've got to word this exactly right or I'm going to offend people. Okay. A written contract is better than oral. Let me say that again. A written contract is better than an oral contract. True or false? Is that true or false? It's false. Absolutely false. Most of the contracts you will do in your life are oral contracts. You are going to form oral contracts dozens of times in a week. Only rarely will you ever enter into an actual written contract. Oral contracts start, offer acceptance, mutual consideration, capacity, legality, and close. They execute all the time with perfect results. Oral contracts, there's nothing wrong with an oral contract. You can say, well, what about that he said, she said? For normal business operations, for normal human operations, you really don't do a written contract that often, you just get the job done. If we had to write a contract for everything we did, we'd never get out of the house in the morning.
Understand this, though. Written contracts are absolutely crucial when there is great detail, as there is oftentimes in business or in personal matters that involve finance or other life-changing matters. So when you have a written contract, there is something that is quite important for you to understand. What is called the parole evidence rule. The parole evidence rule. This is otherwise known as the Four Corners Doctrine. In a written contract, if it is not in the four corners of the written contract, it is not part of the contract. If it is not in the four corners of the written contract, it is not in the contract. I have seen so many examples of this. Well, you know, we talked about this, but you didn't put this in the contract. Oh, you know, we talked about it. Don't worry about it. Or I sent you an email about that, you know, so you got proof. We got that on. No, no, no. If it is not in the contract, or if it is, sometimes you'll have matters surviving the contract. You might say there's something that has to be delivered later or whatever. But nevertheless, if it is not in the contract itself, it is not the contract. So this is where you have to be a biatch when you are doing contracts. You said this, it's not here, so I need that to be there. Otherwise, you don't have, this contract is not, I'm not signing this contract. You can kiss my ass. No. Okay? Now, another one. Expressed versus implied. And it's just what it says. There are many contracts that are implied. Now, there are two different ways it can happen. It can be implied in fact, or it can be implied in law. You're my kid. You're going to say, no, no, I didn't sign a contract. Well, you didn't have to, because the contract is implied in law. Okay? Let's try another one. I decide that I need, I walk in. You are a hairdresser. Now, you're a hairdresser. And you own your own hairdressing service. Dave's Hairdressing. You change your name to Dave. So you're walking around, you come from the back of your hair salon, and you see I'm sitting in a chair. Oh, great. Come on back. We'll get you set up with the usual that we give to handsome young studs. And you do my hair, and you say, well, let's go to the front. You can pay. And you say, oh, no. I say, I'm the one who's getting. I said, no, I didn't ask for a haircut. I was just sitting here. I'm not paying you anything. I didn't contract. I didn't sign anything. There was no oral agreement. But in fact, I still owe you the $50 because it's implied in fact that I was wanting to enter into a contract, okay? So know that. Expressed, you say it. Implied, no. This is the toughest one. Unilateral versus bilateral. Unilateral, let me try to explain. Unilateral versus bilateral. I'll pay you $50 and you'll wash my car.
No.
Well, woman, wait. No, hear me out. I will pay you $50 if you'll wash my car. Those are two fundamentally different contracts. I will pay you $50 and you will wash my car. I will pay you $50 if you will wash my car. This one, the last one, was a unilateral contract. The first one is a bilateral contract. I will pay you $50 and you will wash my car. You see, the fact that I owe her $50 once we agree to this, I owe her $50. It has nothing to do with whether she washes my car or not. She has to wash my car regardless of whether I give her $50 or not. It's a bilateral contract. In this case, I am under no obligation to perform in the contract unless you wash my car. I do not owe you $50. unless and until you wash my car. Unilateral versus bilateral. You got the idea? Now, you might think, well, this is kind of a trivial point. It is actually a huge point. Employment contracts, for example. Look at whether they're unilateral or bilateral. Here at Illinois State, I did not get paid 2 months of salary. Well, if they don't pay me, I don't work. Bullshit. I'm under a bilateral contract. I'm under a bilateral contract, not a unilateral contract. Okay? So in other words, I have to render the service, and they have to pay me. But the two are actually not within the cabin of the contract I have each semester. I and the university have obligations that are not contingent upon each other's performance. Not necessarily. There's some complication in there. But you've got to understand that. And unilateral contracts and bilateral contracts show up all the time. Things you sign, you might think, well, they have to do this, and they can say, no, because you have to do this first, or you have to do this, and you didn't do this, so we don't have to do that. So know that difference. That's enough on contracts for now. Thank you.